Thank you, Lord, for this evening. Thank you for not only the privilege that you give us, but also the responsibility to care well for the people who come through the doors of this building in our ministries to and with them. We pray that you continue to stir up within us that sense of care and protection to create a safe place, not only for the adults who work with kids and youth and vulnerable adults, but for those people as well, so that there is no question of any issue or any problem that goes through this door. Lord, please be with Chris as he leads this seminar. Be with us as we listen well and enable all that is said this evening to be acceptable in your sight and everything we do to be to your honor and glory. All this we thank you for and pray for in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, Chris.
Well, good morning. Good evening. You know, that's the old pastor thing there whenever you meet sometime other than Sunday morning. As Pat said, my name is Chris Kendall. I'm a pastor here in Western Pennsylvania Annual Conference. Currently serving both the annual conference as the role of discipleship and spiritual formation, safe sanctuaries, as Pat said, but I'm also serving a local church, Concord United Methodist Church. It's one of those interesting appointments where I served Concord from 2005 to 2009. I was an associate pastor there, and being a part of this position, the senior pastor of that church came up to me and said, hey, we need another preaching pastor. When I was at Concord the first time, we started a second 11 o'clock service. So at one end of the building, we had a service going on. The other end of the building, we had another service going on. It kind of necessitates two preaching pastors. And so I'm there. I'm back at Concord serving again, and it's been a lot of fun. I'm married. I've been married for 26 years. It'll be 27 years in May. And I have a 15-year-old daughter who is just, she's an extraordinarily awesome human being. She just is growing up to be a wonderful young woman. And it's been a blast being a part of her life. My wife and I are also in the process of adopting a little boy from China. And so if you think about us at all and it comes to mind, you can be in prayer for that process. We started it, April of 2020, and we all know how 2020 and 2021 went. 'Cause that's what you do, right, when there's a pandemic. You decide to adopt again. And so we're patiently waiting, and he will turn 7 in June. And so we're hopefully, things open back up and we're able to travel and bring him home soon. So just a couple things before I get started. If at any time you have a question, please don't hesitate to stop me and ask your question, right? I'm a pastor at heart. And like all pastors, we think we get paid by the word. And so I will talk and talk and talk until someone stops me. So if you have a question, just, hey, can you explain this better? Could you go back a slide? Right, I want you all to understand what we're talking about, really well. Secondly, whenever we talk about abuse and how we try to plan for and prevent abuse, just recognize that there are people present here tonight that very well could have been a victim of abuse at some point. And so simply talking about it can stir up some emotions and some feelings. And if you find yourself in that position, let me encourage you to, talk with Pat. Just recognize that it's not your fault, right? When you're a victim, it's not your fault. And if you feel like you need to step out, please do so, at any time. I want you to have that freedom to be able to do that. So, all right, so Pat's already prayed for us, so we're just going to go ahead and get started. So the purpose of safe sanctuaries is to protect children, to protect youth, to protect vulnerable adults. And you're going to hear that phrase many, many, many times tonight, right? Protect children, youth, and vulnerable adults. It's also here to protect, we're also talking here tonight to talk about how we protect you as volunteers, right? You serve, you volunteer, believing, knowing, hoping that your church is doing everything it can to care for and protect you. Right, Safe Sanctuaries is as much for the volunteer as it is for the children that we are serving to protect. And then it's also to protect the ministry, right? To protect Holiday Park's reputation, to protect God's reputation, right? Because we want to make sure that Holiday Park remains a place where people can come and learn about Jesus and grow closer to him. And so every church is required to have a policy of their own. Right, I didn't drive in from Cranberry Township today bringing with me a policy that says this is the way that you have to do it, right? Because we have got 800-some churches, right, Pat? Something like that? Yeah, 830-something. And so it would be impossible to create a single document that would cover all of those churches and all of the circumstances that we have. And so every church is required to have that policy in place to care for children, youth, and vulnerable adults. And what we're doing, you know, the goal of those policies are to protect them from bodily harm, emotional damage, and spiritual destruction. Now let me kind of flesh that out and explain what I mean when I say that. So I think there's a handful of ways that we can understand Safe Sanctuaries and what Safe Sanctuaries means. Why are we here? You know, one of the reasons or one of the lens through which we can view Safe Sanctuaries is that if we are a church that has a good, strong Safe Sanctuaries program and our community knows it, then we're more likely to get families with children, right? That's one of the ways that we can view Safe Sanctuaries. And, you know, and there's probably a little bit of truth to that. And so from when I started this position in 2013 up to 2019, when I went back to a local church, we visited many churches. And always would take my family along with me. And so one of the ways that I would evaluate every church that I visited was by how they treated my daughter, Sophia. You know, how did they treat my treasure? And the vast majority of the churches, I'm very happy to say, that I would have no problem taking Sophia back to. There were, though, a handful of churches that I would never, ever take my daughter back to, simply because I didn't feel like they cared for her. They didn't protect her in a way that I thought was important and in a way that I thought that they should. And so, you know, this is definitely a way that we can view Safe Sanctuaries, understand Safe Sanctuaries, you know, that if we have it, we're more likely to get families with children. It's not the way that we should view Safe Sanctuaries. One of the ways we can view Safe Sanctuaries is through the financial lens. You know, a very important piece of information. You know, if your church does not have a Safe Sanctuary policy in writing that you're following, and something happens in your church, a case of abuse happens in your church, your insurance company does not have to do anything for you. And so, you know, a case of abuse within the house of God, it's going to run 5 figures, 6 figures, 7 figures. And there aren't very many churches that I know of that could take a 5-figure, 6-figure, 7-figure hit. Right? And so you think about all of what people have done to create this church and this space could all be wiped out in a moment because we don't have a policy. Very important, but I don't think it's the main reason why we view Safe Sanctuaries. Another one of the reasons we can view Safe Sanctuaries is, you know, so I've served 3 local churches, and I've been able to label each one of my churches with a single word. And I think people in our communities do the exact same thing, right? That's a church that if you visit, people actually talk to you. That's the church, if you visit, they bring you a warm plate of cookies. That's the church with those great spaghetti dinners. That's the church where the abuse happened. Right? If the mission statement of the United Methodist Church is to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world, that type of label, right, the church where the abuse happened, is going to significantly hinder us from doing what God has placed us in this community to do. That one comes pretty close, but it's not the reason that I think we should be viewing, talking about Safe Sanctuaries. I think the reason, or the big why behind why we talk about Safe Sanctuaries is a theological one, right? We're a theological people. We can think with that kind of mindset. And so let's think about this. So imagine the worst possible situation. A child is a victim of abuse within the house of God. Because a child, this child is a victim of abuse within the house of God, connects the pain of abuse with Jesus, and never makes a relationship with Jesus their own. And so for 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years, right, this child, this person holds Jesus at an arm's length. And in the short term, they miss out on the love and the joy and the hope, the peace, the purpose that having a relationship with Jesus brings, you know, the blessing of being a part of a church family. And that's just in the short term, right? Because, again, we're a theological people and we can think with a theological lens. And so let's stretch that one out a little bit longer. So a child is a victim of abuse within the house of God, connects the pain of abuse with Jesus, never makes a relationship with Jesus their own, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years here on earth, and then they enter into an eternity without Jesus. And the church will have participated in the destruction of a soul. Right? The exact opposite reason why we're called to be here. Right? We're called to be here to make disciples of Jesus, not enemies, not people who will refuse him. So that, to me, is the reason why we're here. That's the big reason. That's the thing that keeps me up at night, that no one would ever connect the pain of abuse with Jesus Christ. And so, again, it is every church's responsibility to have that policy in place where they can care for and protect children, youth, and vulnerable adults. Now, there are certainly helps that we have as an annual conference, right? That's part of my job is to help churches navigate those policies. We have sample policies. We've got a beginning policy where if you don't have one, right, you can kind of fill in the blanks and create your own. All those things are available, but it's the church that has to do that. 2022, right? I've been in this position now since 2013. There are still churches that I encounter that do not have safe sanctuary policies, and it just blows my mind, right? I came into the annual conference in 2000, and this was the big thing, right? Everybody was talking about safe sanctuaries in 2000. And so it just seems to me it's been my entire career as a pastor has been involved with safe sanctuaries. So, but they are still out there. So why is it needed? I think obviously there's a biblical mandate for safe sanctuaries. Definitely when you look at the Old Testament, there is this common refrain that is repeated by God to God's people, right? To care for the widow, to care for the orphan, to care for the alien in our midst. Right, it is a call from God to care for, to protect, to stand up for those who cannot stand up for themselves, who cannot protect themselves, who do not have a voice. Right, and God says to God's people, look, take this seriously. This is your part of your role here on earth, to stand up for people who cannot stand up for themselves. Then, you know, the New Testament passage from John 10, I'm a visual person, and whenever I have thought about safe sanctuaries over the years, it always conflicts with the way that I understand the church, right? You know, to me, the church is symbolizes with arms open wide, you know, Jesus, come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. Where safe sanctuaries feels a little bit like the stiff arm, right, where we're holding people at an arm's length, right? Can we trust you? I don't know you, stranger danger. And so how do you rectify this with this? Well, then you come across John 10:10, and it was not 10:10, that's a different verse, different sermon altogether. But in John chapter 10, it talks about Jesus being the gate. And when I came across this passage, I thought, oh, this is it, right? Because Jesus, you know, is the gate. And what's the purpose of a gate? The purpose of the gate is to keep things in and to keep things out, right? But in order to get to the sheep who are behind the gate, you've got to get through the gate. And that's what we get to do as a church, right? We get to imitate Jesus, and we get to stand there welcoming the world in, welcoming the wounded, welcoming the hurting in, all the while knowing that in order to get to the most vulnerable, that you have to get through us first. So we still get to be welcoming, and we still get to be protecting. And to me, that just is a great way to understand safe sanctuaries. Secondly, there's a conference mandate. So the General Conference of 1996, now I don't know how clued in you are to greater things Methodism, but especially General Conference, but a miracle happened in 1996 where the General Conference actually agreed on something. Now, this is a big deal, right? And what they agreed on was that to be a United Methodist, right, or that the United Methodist Church was going to stand for the protection of children and youth and vulnerable adults in these areas of abuse. And so and every 4 years since 1996, our church has said, yes, this is important to us. Yes, this is part of what it means to be a United Methodist. When I've gone to different types of trainings, it's always cool because the trainers will point out the fact that the United Methodist Church has been on the forefront of this, right? We have been ahead of the curve, and so that's something I think we can take some pride in with our church. Now, thirdly, the third one, open hearts, open doors, I put that there as a placeholder. That was a part of a phrase that Igniting Ministries had, you know, open hearts, open minds, open doors. The people of the United Methodist Church. And I put that there because, you know, as I've traveled to, you know, many, many, many churches, one thing I have never come across when I have gone into a church was a list of sins, a list of things that if you have done this, you are not allowed in there. And I looked when I was on my way into Holiday Park, right? There was no sign that says, if you have done X, Y, or Z, you were not welcome here, right? Because the church, this is a place where you know, sinful people come to be reconciled to a loving and holy God. Now, that being said, it is 2022. And if you haven't done so recently, let me encourage you to Google Pennsylvania Megan's Law. You Google Pennsylvania Megan's Law, you'll come across a website that will enable you to type in your address and put a circumference, and you will find out how many registered sex offenders live within 5 miles, half a mile from your home, or half, you know, 5 miles from your church. And I don't say that so that then you put those pictures on the door, right? Because church is a place where broken and sinful people come to be made right with a loving and holy God, right? This is a place for sinners. But when I say that, that means we have to have our acts together. We have to be very good at what we're doing to be inviting the world in to care for our children, youth, and vulnerable adults. I had a friend who, in his church, at any given time, he had up to 4 registered sex offenders attending his church. And they had a very good safe sanctuary policy because you understand the risks, right? What we're called to, but we also understand the risks. And then lastly, all of the new Pennsylvania laws, which really aren't so new anymore. They date back a handful of years, but we'll talk about those when they kind of come in contact with what we're talking about with safe sanctuaries. So statistically, there are 3 million reported cases of abuse every year. That's 8,219 every day, 342 per hour. That's more than 8 every minute and more than 1 every 15 seconds. So you think about it, if we're here for 2 hours tonight talking about how we prevent abuse, there will be 684 cases of abuse just in the time of us talking about how we prevent it. Now, the scary thing about that slide is that my undergraduate degree was in criminology. And when I look at that slide, the word that really jumps out at me is reported. Because of the nature of this crime, nature of all crimes are underreported. But because of the type of crime we're talking about, what that 3 million reported cases a year really says is that there are at least 6 million cases, and that's a very conservative guess, at least 6 million reported cases, if not more, every year. That breaks down, by the age of 18, one in every three girls and one in every six boys or five boys, depending upon the study that you're reading, is sexually abused. Now, thankfully, you know, there seems to be a tide that has been turned in church. That I remember when I first started this position, I would go and churches would tangle with me. And they'd say, we don't need to have this here. And I would say, well, you know, that's great. Next Sunday, simply do the math and count off 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And get an understanding of the pervasive nature of this evil in our world. Let alone the statistic that well over 70%, close to 80% of victims know their abusers. And so those churches who say, well, we don't need this because we know everybody. I say, that's exactly why you need it. Because it's not stranger danger. And a stranger danger rarely happens. It happens. It's horrible. But more often than not, a victim is always going to know their abuser. And so we have to pay attention. So some definitions for us as we talk tonight. Children are birth through sixth grade, youth or seventh through 12th grade. Pennsylvania law code will simply say children for that demographic, you know, birth through 12th grade, birth through 18 years of age. And sometimes I'll simply say children as well, but if you hear me say that, understand I'm talking about everybody under the age of 18. Vulnerable adults fall into two different categories. We have those who are mentally and physically disabled could fall into that category. Sometimes our older adults might be considered vulnerable. But also, Safe Sanctuaries understands that anybody who is volunteering would be considered a vulnerable adult. Because another thing you're going to hear me say a handful of times tonight is that an accusation does not need to be true to ruin a life. And so as volunteers, Safe Sanctuaries is for you and for your protection. Right? It is extremely important on every front. It's good for our kids and it's good for our volunteers. So next I'm going to go through... we're going to define the different categories of abuse. Yes, does somebody have a question? Go back one slide? Yeah. And the church has this PowerPoint too. And so anybody who would want this PowerPoint needs to get a hold of Mr. Ed or Pat, and we can shoot those emails out to you or shoot the PowerPoints out to you. Because we want everybody to understand this as best they can. Is it okay to go forward? Okay. So we're going to be talking about the different categories of abuse in the Pennsylvania Crime Code, and then there's one added by the author of Safe Sanctuaries. And so the first one is physical abuse. And physical abuse is defined as abuse in which a person deliberately and intentionally causes bodily harm to a child. Right, it could be striking with a fist, with an open hand, shaking, choking, hitting with a strap or a belt, extinguishing cigarettes on a body. All those types of things fall under the rubric of physical abuse. And some things for us to be aware of, right? So if God places us in a position where we might see something, you know, right, we can imitate Jesus and be that gate. And so some red flags for us to pay attention to would be hostile or aggressive behavior towards others, fearfulness of parents or other adults, destructive behavior towards self, others, or property, burns, facial injuries, patterns of repetitious bruises could all be a sign or a symptom of physical abuse. Here's that old kind of old standby example where you have you're doing vacation Bible school in the heat of a Pennsylvania summer, right? It's 90 degrees with 200% humidity, and you got that young guy who comes to and he's wearing long sleeves and long pants, and he doesn't want to roll anything up, right? Because he doesn't want you to see the scars. He doesn't want you to see the burns. And if that's happening, you know, Lord, give us the eyes to see, right? If this is happening in front of us, please help us to see this so that we can stand in front of it and stop abuse from happening. Nextly, we have emotional abuse. Pennsylvania would term this as serious mental abuse, and this is defined as abuse in which a person exposes a child to spoken and or unspoken violence or emotional cruelty. So here's like an example, because all these definitions I've just copied from Pennsylvania Crime Code, exposes a child. Anybody under the age of 18 is who they're talking about. They're not talking about an infant. They're talking about a 17-year-old. Right, so anybody who causes exposes a child to spoken and or unspoken violence or emotional cruelty, it's conveying the sense of being unloved or unlovable. It's incredibly damaging. Right, physical abuse will often leave some sort of outward manifestation. Right, we have a scar, and sometimes those things will fade away. Whereas emotional abuse, I think it damages our DNA. It affects us, who we are. And, you know, I've often wondered in ministry just how many people when I'm dealing with folks that maybe they were victims of emotional abuse in their background. I was doing a training up in Grove City with Mercer County Children and Youth Services, and the worker who was there from CYS, she had been employed for 17 years at that point, and she had only seen two cases of emotional abuse go to trial, which is extremely difficult to prove. It happens a lot, but it's extremely difficult to prove. And so some red flags for us: exhibiting severe depression or withdrawal, exhibiting a severe lack of self-esteem. Now, you know, I don't want you to think, you know, every member of our youth group is now suddenly a victim of emotional abuse. We're not talking normal teenage angst. You know, we're talking about a change in behavior. You know, you've got that happy-go-lucky child that all of a sudden there is a drastic change. Failure to thrive, speech or eating disorders, going to extremes to seek parental approval, extreme passive-aggressive behavior could all be a sign or a symptom of emotional abuse. Next, we have neglect, or which Pennsylvania would define this as serious physical neglect, abuse in which a person endangers a child's health, safety, or welfare through negligence. Now, this is by far the biggest category of abuse that Children and Youth Services have to deal with. Neglect could be, you know, you don't have proper medical care, you don't have proper dental care, improper clothing for the seasons, lack of food, lack of hygiene, all could be something that would fall under this category, this rubric of neglect. And so, again, some things to think about, like failure to thrive, pattern of inappropriate dress for climate, begging or stealing for food, chronic hunger. You know, I have friends who are in the foster care world, and they've talked about this with me, you know, and most of us know where our next meal is going to come from. Right, most of us have not been really, really hungry. You know, we might think like, oh, I missed lunch. I'm really hungry. Like, we don't really know hunger. You know, there are children out there who they don't know where their next meal is coming from, and so they will squirrel away food, and they will hide it, and they will hoard it, just out of a sense of desperation and self-preservation. Right. This isn't the normal. This isn't that teenage boy who eats everything. Right. Because God makes teenage boys with empty legs. This is somebody who has experienced true hunger before. And it terrifies them. And so they hoard food. Depression, untreated medical conditions, or poor hygiene all could fall under this category of neglect. And so we've talked so far, right, we've covered physical abuse, we've covered emotional abuse, we've covered neglect. Next, we have sexual abuse. And sexual abuse is defined as abuse in which sexual contact between a child and an adult or a more powerful youth occurs. Right, a child is never able to give consent. And so that's just important for us to remember. And this isn't just intercourse. It could be exposure to or exploitation with pornography. It could be fondling. It could be incest. There's lots of different things that fall under this category of sexual abuse. And so some things for us to be thinking about. Unusual advanced knowledge or advanced sexual knowledge or behavior, depression, crying for no reason, promiscuous behavior, difficulty walking or sitting, bruised, bleeding in the vaginal or anal areas, exhibiting frequent headaches, stomach aches, extreme fatigue, or sexually transmitted diseases. You know, it could all be a sign or a symptom, or just, you know, a hand hoping that somebody would see the hell that they're going through. You know, some other things for church to be thinking about: unusual nervousness or anxiety at being left alone in nursery or Sunday school class, reluctance to participate in church activities once enthusiastically approached. Right? Maybe Susie and her friend just got into a fight, and so she doesn't want to go to youth group anymore. Maybe it's something worse. You know, God, give me the eyes to see. Comments such as, I don't want to be left alone with so-and-so. Please do not let that phrase be uttered without you really hearing it. And if it's uttered, pay attention to it. Nightmares, hostility towards child care teacher or worker, could all other signs or symptoms of sexual abuse. Yes. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so if you couldn't hear that, just poor hygiene, right? Because they're trying to repel an abuser. Yeah. You know, God, give us the eyes to see if we come in contact with that. Physical, emotional, neglect, sexual. Those all come out of the Pennsylvania Crime Code. This next one, ritualistic abuse, does not exist in Pennsylvania Crime Code. Joy Melton, the author of Safe Sanctuaries, United Methodist lawyer. She might be a lay preacher, too. I don't remember that. But she's the creator. And so she adds this, again, because we are a theological people. And so I'll read this, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it. So ritualistic abuse is defined as abuse in which physical, sexual, psychological violations of a child are inflicted regularly, intentionally, and in a stylized way by a person or persons responsible for the child's welfare. Now, Pennsylvania would simply break that down into physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, emotional abuse. But again, because we understand we're theological people, we can understand this differently. Now, Joy has been in Western Pennsylvania a handful of times, and I've heard her speak a handful of times, and she has shared, unfortunately, a true story of ritualistic abuse as a way to help define what ritualistic abuse is. And so she talks about a church that is someplace down south. She's never identified the church, at least when I've been a part of her trainings. But this church, what it had was a children's church. So mom and dad would come. They'd bring mom, dad, grandma, grandpa. They'd bring little Johnny, little Susie to church, and they'd drop them off downstairs for children's church, and then they'd go upstairs for their church. And, you know, thinking this is awesome, right? Because they get to sing, you know, This Little Light of Mine and Shadrach, and learn about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and then we get to go up to, you know, adult church, and we get to hear a pastor and sing our songs. And what had happened in this one particular church was that there was a group of Satanists that had infiltrated the children's ministry to the point where they had really complete ownership of it. And so when mom and dad, grandma and grandpa were dropping off little Johnny and little Susie, what was happening was that they would take the children out of the space, right? They would take them to a third place, which was near the church. They would use the children in satanic rituals. There was sexual components to the rituals. And they told the kids that if you say anything, we'll kill your mom and your dad. And this went on for 2 years. You imagine, you know, you're coming to church and you're singing, you're worshiping, you're praising God, and the hell is right below your feet. You know, it's terrible. It all went on until one day this little girl came, you know, running out. Run, Mommy, Daddy, run. They're going to kill you. They're going to kill you. And everything began to unravel. Earlier I talked about how, you know, our communities label our churches, right? You imagine the label that that church had, right? That's the church where that happened. And because she's never mentioned the church, I don't know if it still exists or not. I don't know how it could exist, only by the grace of God. But so that's kind of an example of ritualistic abuse. And so some red flags: disruptions of memory or consciousness, unexplained mistrust or mood swings, flashbacks, eating disorders, fear of the dark, especially at sundown or full moon, fear of ministers, priests, or others wearing robes or uniforms. All could be a sign or a symptom of ritualistic abuse. So, okay. Any questions on anything I've talked about so far? Okay, the good news is we're done with the yick part, right? We're done with that part. And now we get to talk about, okay, so now that we know what is out there, what can we do to create a safe sanctuary? You know, how do we make sure our children, youth, and vulnerable adults are safe? And so the first foundational piece of a safe sanctuary is that there are at least two adults in every classroom who are not related or cohabitating. Now, at this point, I need to pause and ask you if you remember that I said I did not bring a policy with me that says this is the way that you have to do it. Right, you guys remember me saying that? And I bring that up because I'm giving you all of the best practices. And again, I have been a pastor, and I know how difficult this statement is. At least two adults in every classroom who aren't related or cohabitating. And so what some churches choose to do is that they'll say at least two adults in every classroom, and they'll put a period after that. And they leave off the who aren't related or cohabitating. And you can do that, right? Your policies have to say what you can and are going to be doing. Your policies are not what we want to do, what we hope to do, what we long to do. Right, they have to talk about what we're going to be doing week in and week out. And so if you can't have two adults in every classroom who aren't related or cohabitating, then do not have that in your policy. Now, the problem with whenever we alter any of the best practices, we always increase risk. And so let me explain this a little bit, right? So if I'm teaching a Sunday school class with my wife, Jan, and an accusation is made against me, Jan has got some skin in the game. Right, we have a last name together, our finances are commingled together, we have a daughter, I make the greater portion of our income, and so if something happens to me, it's really going to affect the family, it's going to affect our daughter, right? And so Jan's got some skin in the game, and so her testimony is going to be viewed very differently in a court of law than if I'm teaching a class with Pat. Now, Pat, would you feel bad for me if somebody made an accusation against me? Thank you. Pat would feel bad for me. I didn't do it, so we can all feel bad for me. But you know what? Pat doesn't have any skin in the game. We're not married. Our incomes are not commingled. We don't have a child together, right? And so it is far safer for me, it's far safer for Pat, it's far safer for the children, for us to be teaching a Sunday school class than it is for me and my wife. But again, you can't have that in your policy unless you're going to do it, right? Because Mr. and Mrs. Smith got married because they like each other. They probably want to teach Sunday school class together. And so you can change that and say two adults in every classroom, right? The church I serve, that's what we have done, right? We chose to go that route simply because of our volunteer situation. So don't feel like if you can't go with the best practice that you are somehow in sin. The idea is never to leave a child alone with one adult. It's best if these two people aren't related. Now, if you can't have two people in a classroom, right? So the best practice, two people who aren't related, who aren't cohabitating. Next best, two people. Next best, you have one person in a classroom and you have a floater. And so you have a space like this. So I took a look at your gym. And, your gym is a great example of a wonderful space where with a couple of flexible walls, you could have multiple teaching spaces in your gymnasium. And you could have a single teacher in each one of those teaching spots. And it's a very open space. It's a very safe space. And if you really want to bump it up a notch, you could have somebody who roams and kind of helps periodically at each one of those stations. Right, that's a very safe space for to be put in. So, the idea is, if you can't do this, then you got to do this, and if you can't do this, then you've got to do this. And so, what are the best ways we can approach this and make sure that not only are our children safe, but as volunteers, that we're safe as well? So this is where kind of the first of our Pennsylvania laws, statutes come into play. And so January 1 of 2015, it was signed into law that all volunteers having contact with children shall have, meaning you've gotta, right, this is the law, you need to have the 33, which is the Pennsylvania Childline Child Abuse Clearance, and the Act, the Pennsylvania Act 34, Pennsylvania State Police Criminal Background Check. Right, so all volunteers have to have those two. Right, it used to be churches would say, well, if there are two people, as long as one person has their clearances, right, this law says no. If there's an adult and a youth, like, no, all volunteers having contact with children shall have, meaning you've got to. So in addition to these two, the law also says that if you have not been a Pennsylvania resident for the last 10 consecutive years, then you will also need to have the FBI record check. Right? So now, these two are free. So from the law came into effect January 1st of 2015. From January 1st to about July 20th, these two things cost $8 apiece, and they had to be redone every 3 years. That was put into place by Governor Corbett. In July 21st of 2015, Governor Wolf altered the law and made these two things free for all volunteers and changed the length to which they are good to 5 years. Right? So if you are a volunteer, you can get a free Pennsylvania clearance, Childline and State Police, every 57 months. Right, because every 60 months is when you need to have new clearance, every 5 years. And so you're allowed by law to get a free clearance every 57 months. And clearances are good across platforms, right? So if you're teaching Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, after school program, volunteering in church, you can use all of these volunteer clearances for those purposes. We have a teacher here. You cannot use a volunteer clearance for your job, right? They want a professional clearance. Now, if your school will allow you to copy your clearance, you can use it certainly for Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, church, things like that. You can use professionals for this level. You just can't use this level for professional purposes. Now, so in the Pennsylvania resident for the last 10 consecutive years, that was the add-in. This is never free. And it's never free. And for Monroeville area, right, would you call this Monroeville? What do you call this, Murrysville? Pittsburgh? Plum. Okay. So this area, right, you're not near West Virginia, New York, Ohio. Those churches on our boundaries tend to deal with this a little bit more. Of course, you're in a larger area, so you might have people coming and going, but so if they have not been in Pennsylvania for 10 years, they need to have the FBI record check. These are the codes. So currently, Pennsylvania is contracted with Identigo. So if you need FBI record checks, you have to go to the Identigo website and enter into these six-digit codes to get a FBI clearance. Employee or volunteer, because we'll talk about paid employees here soon enough. These aren't in your handouts because these change. Like when I first made the handouts, we were with Cogent and we didn't have to have codes. And we have since gone to Identigo, and so we have to have the codes. These are on our conference website. All of my contact information is also on the bulletin, their handout. And so you can give me a call for these things at any point. And as I've already said, the clearances are good for every 5 years. So any questions on two adults in every classroom or for volunteer clearances? Yes.
Is the nursery a classroom?
Is the nursery a classroom? Yes. Yeah, if you're taking care of children, you're definitely. Mm-hmm. Any others? Okay. So the second foundational piece to creating a safe sanctuary is that we want to make sure that all doors have windows, right? We want to have doors, windows in our classrooms, offices, supply closets to a limited extent. We like windows because windows allow for accountability, right? At any time, a parent could walk past. You know, you got that nervous parent who looks and says, hey, my child is okay. And as a volunteer, you know that at any time, somebody could be looking in and seeing you, right? So those windows allow for accountability. And as church people, right, we don't mind accountability. And if we're doing something in church that we don't want somebody else to see, we probably shouldn't be doing it in church. Now, the chemical closets, supply closets that are locked, they don't necessarily need windows in the doors, right, because they're limited access, right? You have to have a key to get in there. It's never a bad idea to put a window in the door, right? Those supply closets, sometimes they're big enough. You know, you just put a window, and it just gives peace of mind. If you put a window in your boiler room door, check with your fire code, and they'll tell you what needs to happen with that. Yes, sir. I can. Well, if they're locked, it's not that big a deal, the supply closets. You know, any kind of door, it's always best to have a window in it because it just allows for accountability. I'm having trouble hearing you. I'm sorry.
I'm talking about a supply
closet
in the classroom.
A supply closet in the classroom. Yeah, if that supply closet, if it can be closed and people can be in it, like if it's a closet where you just close it and it's right up to the door with shelving and nobody can really go in there, then you don't need a window. But if people can go in there and have privacy, then a window is not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. Sure. Don't put windows in bathroom doors. That is the one door we'll say there should be no windows, right? It will just cause more problems than it's worth. And it's just very creepy. I've gone to churches like where they have retrofitted rooms, old churches, and there's like a door with a window, and it's a bathroom. Those are very odd, awkward. Yes. Right. You know, the best practice is to have windows in all of these spaces, you know. I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, that's kind of that's an awkward question. You know, I understand the need for privacy when you're breastfeeding and, Yeah. What's that? Leave the door open, leave it cracked, something like that. You know, yeah, that's a good question. Boy, that's a stumper. I don't know if I have a good answer for you. Mm-hmm. Wow. Like I said, I've been doing this since 2013. I've never heard that question before. That's fun. I always get something new. So I'll have to look into that. I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's a really good answer for it. You know, if you put a window, you might make a mom uncomfortable, but it just becomes safe in that sense. So it's, I guess, yeah, gosh, I don't know. I'll have to think about that one. Okay. Any questions about windows besides that one, the stumper? All right, so number three, no person in authority should be less than 18 years of age. Right, we want to make sure that we keep at least 5 years between the oldest child or youth and the leader or helper. Right, we want to maintain a developmental gap between who's helping and who's being helped. I remember when Sophia was 8 years old, wanting to help with nursery. And she was not ready to help with nursery. She just probably would have been a little bit, she would have caused the teacher more work, right? Because there wasn't a developmental gap. There wasn't that much difference between her and the kids that she wanted to be working with. My last church that I served up in St. Mary's, I remember doing vacation Bible school. And our vacation Bible school went through fifth grade. And that year I happened to be doing games, and my helpers for games were a couple sixth grade boys. And it was a disaster, right? Because there's no difference between a sixth grade boy and a fifth grade boy. They just wanted to play. They wanted to goof around. And so, you know, that developmental gap really needed to happen there. 19-year-old youth leaders and 18-year-old youth. I can tell you horror stories of 19-year-old youth leaders and 18-year-old youth. And if she is 18 and he's 19, so theoretically he's older, but, you know, a 19-year-old guy is only about 12 years old mentally, and an 18-year-old female is 30. So it's like a very lopsided relationship, power dynamic. If you're going to use 19, 20, 21-year-olds in youth group, right, pair them up with older adults, you know, putting them in positions where they're in sole in charge is just, it's a dangerous game. And so you want to, you know, like, I'm a big service guy, right? Being a servant is part of being a disciple. But we also don't want to put people in positions where it isn't good for them, right? And so pair those younger helpers with some older adults to walk alongside of them to help them. So any questions on that so far? Okay. Number four, for all activities or ministries with children, there should be a sign-in and a sign-out process, procedure, right? We want to make sure that when somebody is dropping off a child, that the appropriate parent picks that child up. True story. One of the churches that Jan and I visited, we took Sophia. Obviously, we took Sophia with us every Sunday, but in this particular church, they had Sunday school during the church hour. So we dropped Sophia off in Sunday school. We went to church. After church, we went to go pick her up. And they gave us a different child. Now, for us, you know, in a sense, we could laugh about it. Like, Sophia's just off in the corner, and she's busy playing. She's thrilled to death, you know. It's like, well, we were kind of partial to the child we brought. We'd like to take her home rather than this one. As awesome as this one might be, we like our daughter. We joke about it, and we have joked about it, but I think something we all forget when we are involved with church for any length of time, we forget how terrifying it is to go to a church that you don't belong to, where you haven't grown up in it, right? Every church thinks they're wonderfully friendly, and most churches are very friendly to the people they know. And breaking into a church has got to be one of the most terrifying things a person can do. And so you imagine, you know, you got this young mother, young father who brings their child, right? They're wooed by God, prevenient grace. They're drawn to church. And they bring their baby. They bring their child. And something like that happens. I don't know if they ever come back. Right? Because we didn't take care of their treasure. And so, you know, this isn't just good safe sanctuary policy. I mean, if we want to be a church that welcomes the world in and makes disciples of Jesus Christ, then this is something we really need to take seriously. And so when you drop a child off, right, you want to capture some important information, right? You get the parent's name, you get the parent's cell phone, obviously the child's name. Who can pick the child up? Right, and so if Jan drops Sophia off to a Sunday school class, and I go to pick Sophia up afterwards, and my name is not on the list, I should not be allowed to pick up my child. Right, the Sunday school teacher should all know that. Okay, you're not Jan Kindle. Like, so you know, you're visiting a church. Asking for ID is perfectly acceptable. Like, so you're not on the list. We can't let you take your child. You capture the cell phone number of the person who dropped off, so you can call Jan and say, hey, Jan, Chris is here to pick up the child, pick up Sophia. Is it okay if he takes her? Right? You're going to hear one of two things when you make that phone call. Oh, yeah, that's fine. I should have put him down. No problem. Or you're going to hear, call 911. He's not supposed to have anything to do with her. This year, right, there was a child kidnapped from church by a non-custodial parent. You know, don't be the Sunday school teacher who's got to make that phone call. You know, I'm sorry, we let your child go with the parent that isn't supposed to have them. Now, the good story ends out fine. The child was recovered. Everybody was safe, but... Again, I think you lose a family from ever attending your church. So, you know, you want to know who's allowed to pick up the child. So we don't let children just go, right? Every church I've been in has millions of doors. There are millions of ways for people to come in and people to go out. So parents, come and get your kids. Older youth should not be allowed to pick up younger siblings. Right, we just want to make sure our kids are safe. They are with who they need to be with. There are lots of different, you know, there are iPad applications. You can use stickers, all sorts of things. You know, there's not a better one than another. It's just we have to do it. You know, we've got to work the process because we want to keep our kids safe. Youth also should go through some sort of sign-in and sign-out process as well. It simply allows for accountability to know who we are responsible for. Wouldn't be the first time that mom and dad dropped off Johnny and Johnny walked in the front door of the church, out of the back door of the church, only to return 2 hours later when they're being picked up. You know, by taking attendance, by having the sign-in and sign-out sheet, we also now have record that Johnny was here, and so if Johnny breaks his leg during a mean game of Foursquare, our insurance can come to play. You know, so we want to make sure that we sign in our youth as well. So whether that's mom and dad or the youth themselves, we want to make sure that they all sign in. And, you know, additionally, if there's a fire, you grab that list. You know exactly who you're responsible for. And it's just really important. If you have a ministry with vulnerable adults, like my home church has had a long ministry with mentally and physically challenged adults, and so they're always brought in. They always have like a helper with them, and so everybody gets signed in simply because we want to know who we're responsible for as a church. If there's a fire, simple attendance. It allows us to know. And if somebody drops off, like, we can follow up and say, hey, we haven't seen you in a while. Hope everything's okay. So sign in and sign out sheets are just incredibly important. Number 5, 6-month rule for new attenders. right? 6 months active within the congregation before volunteering with children, youth, or vulnerable adults. Right? I like to think of this as our hospitality guideline, that we are able as a church to give a gift. That a lot of people, when they come to a new church, they come to an organization because they're using the resources of an organization, they feel like they have to participate in it, right? I'm using your youth group, and so I've got to volunteer with youth group. I'm using your children's ministry, so I've got to volunteer with children's ministry, right? We get to say as a church, look, we are so blessed that you are here with us, and we want to give you a season of time for you to get to know us. And for us to get to know you, right? We want to give you a season of time so you can figure out where you might best serve within the life of Holiday Park. You know, it's almost like dating, right? We're just getting to know each other in that sense. Now, you know, 22 years, I've shared that many times, and most of the time it's received very well, right? People hear it. They understand why we're saying it. Right, because we care for your kids. We're doing what we can to care for and protect your kids. Been a couple times where I have said that, you know, I shared my hospitality speech, and those people got so mad at me that they left the church and never came back, never saw them again. I mean, I remember standing, like, right there at my church. Someone who attended church that morning came up, introduced themselves and said, hey, we love this church. We want to come back and help with youth tonight. And I tell them the reasons why they, you know, the gift I want to give them, right? Just, we want to get to know you. We want you to get to know us. And, you know, they never saw them again. I don't want to think anything bad of anybody, right? But predators are exactly like everybody else. They don't want to have to wait. They want what they want, and they want it now. And predators have to go through a process called grooming, where they engender trust with the person that they are trying to abuse. And this six-month thing, our six-month hospitality guideline, slows everything down. And so somebody who comes to your church with nefarious purposes are more likely to go someplace else, right? They're going to go down the street to where they don't have to wait 6 months. And that's not the goal, right? The goal isn't that they're going to go down to the Baptists or the Presbyterians or the Lutherans, right? I hope that they're doing exactly what we're doing right now, right? We want a lot of frustrated predators. We want a lot of safe sanctuaries. You know, the idea is that we slow things down so that we prevent things as much as possible. You know, current church growth statistics will say that, you know, overwhelming number, it's in the 78 percentile, I think it is, that people will say that if they attend church twice a month, they consider themselves regular church attenders. And there was one that was done, and it was something like 40% of people believe that if they attend church one Sunday a month, they are regular church attenders, you know. I would never let somebody who came to my church six times have access to my kids. You know, it's just, it's far too important. They're far too special. So I use a six-month rule as kind of a baseline. And if somebody wants to show up every week, that's awesome. It'll happen quickly. Now, that's not to say that they can't be in men's studies or women's studies. They can't get involved in Sunday school. We're just saying that anything that has to do with children or youth or vulnerable adults, we're asking them to wait at least 6 months so that we can know them well. So, any questions about that? You know, if mom, you get a new family, say you're having a church hayride, and mom wants to go on the hayride because Johnny's nervous, and more than likely, you know, mom's nervous. And I'm that dad, you know. I mean, I'm a helicopter parent, probably, you know. I feel that way about Sophia with a lot of things. And, you know, so you got that parent who wants to protect their child. They can go on that hayride, right? But they sit in the corner, and their job is simply to provide comfort for their child, right? They don't drive anybody. They're never alone with anybody. They don't take anybody to the bathroom. They're not a helper in a pinch. And so if you have an adult who wants to sit in on a Sunday school class for the same reason, you know, yeah, cool, you can do that, you know, but you just, you're not going to be a helper. You're not going to say anything. You're not going to take anybody to the bathroom. You're just there to provide comfort for your child. And eventually, then at some point, if that continues, it becomes an issue where you just, you know, hey, we have an adult Sunday school class where you can be a participant in. So, are we good? All right. I'm either doing really good or you guys just want to get out of here as quickly as possible. I know how these things work. Number six, reference and background checks for volunteers and employees. Right, we just want to know who it is who is working with our children, youth, or vulnerable adults. Now, I'm not saying that volunteers need to fill out an application, right? The information that we have from volunteers should be gotten through other means, right? Names, phone numbers, where they work, where they've lived, things like that. But definitely for employees, we want to have an application process. You do reference checks for staff. I've seen churches do reference checks for volunteers. There's definitely that possibility. You want to make sure you do the proper criminal background checks and have all of your volunteers go through some aspect of Safe Sanctuary training, right? They need to know what they're responsible for in order to take care of children and the youth. And so, again, Pennsylvania law, so the volunteer was only had to get to 33 and 34. Well, all paid staff, according to Pennsylvania law, have to have 33, 34, and the FBI record check, right? So, and again, it's paid and works with or who has access to children. So often a question that we'll get over the years or I've gotten over the years is, what about the church secretary? Does the church secretary need to have the FBI record check? And, well, the church secretary doesn't work with children, but the church secretary has access to children. And so we've taken a stance at the conference center to say, yes, we believe that the church secretary should have the FBI record check. What about the church custodian? Well, the church custodian doesn't work with children, but has access to children. And so we would say that the church custodian should have the FBI record check. What about that part-time treasurer who works off-site? All right, well, doesn't work with children, doesn't have access to children because they're working off-site. But, you know, if you're going to have a treasurer, it'd be nice to have the state police criminal background check on somebody like that. They're dealing with the church's money. So this is like the minimum. Right, 33, 34, and the FBI record check. And for volunteers, 33, 34, and if needed, the FBI record check. There are churches in our annual conference who require this for everybody. Right, and it's largely because they live on a boundary. And they have lots of people who are going to need the FBI record check, and so they require everybody to get the FBI record check. You know, as a church, you can always require more than what Pennsylvania requires. You cannot require less. You can require more, but you cannot require less. And so these are the same numbers that I shared earlier. Hopefully you're getting an understanding of what Safe Sanctuaries is. Like, why does Safe Sanctuaries work? And it isn't because we have two adults in every classroom. And it isn't because we've got clearances. And it isn't because we've got windows. And it isn't because we've got the developmental gap, and it isn't because we've got that 6 month. We know who we're working with. It's all of the layers together is what makes Safe Sanctuaries possible. What makes Safe Sanctuaries strong. Like in that instance, you know, and it's going to happen, right? Where you're teaching a class, and somebody needs to go use the restroom, right? And if they're young, you don't want them going off by themselves, and so somebody has to go with them. And now you're in a classroom where you are by yourself, right? It's like you're violating Safe Sanctuaries, right? Because we say two adults in every classroom. Well, the two adults in every classroom is not what keeps us safe. It's all of those layers is what keeps us safe. And so in that brief time where somebody's taking a child to a restroom and coming back, we're covered, we're protected by all of those layers. And so everything I've shared thus far, everything's been defensive. Right. This is how we protect. This is how we, you know, this is our stance to keep a safe sanctuary. This number seven is kind of our offensive rule. Understanding who has to report and why. And so you may have heard the term mandated reporter. So we're going to talk a little bit about the mandated reporter law that Pennsylvania has. So I'm going to skip forward here a little bit. So in 2014, the law came to be that these people were considered mandated reporters. So any clergy person is automatically considered a mandated reporter, right? Of an established church, not an internet church, come here, fly by night type of a thing. But then it goes on to say any individual who is paid or unpaid on the basis of the individual's role as a integral part of a regularly scheduled program, activity, or service accepts responsibility for a child is considered a mandated reporter. So what that is saying is that if you are the pastor, you are paid, and so Pat is a mandated reporter over the entire demographic of 18 and under, right? Because she's the poobah. I just made that one up. If you have a youth pastor, right, the youth pastor will be over the youth age demographic, whatever you say, whatever is in a job description, seventh grade and up, sixth grade and up, whatever that is. A youth pastor is responsible for that age demographic. If you have a children's minister, right, whatever that age demographic is for the children's minister. So those are all paid, possibly paid individuals. Now, if you are teaching first and second grade Sunday school class, you are a mandated reporter for first and second grade Sunday school class. You're not a mandated reporter for third and fourth, right? Because you are not accepting responsibility for third and fourth grade Sunday school class, right? Whatever group you are accepting responsibility for, you are a mandated reporter for, okay? Now, what that means in Pennsylvania law is that if you witness abuse, if you suspect abuse, if you're told about abuse by somebody under the age of 18, or if somebody 14 or older tells you that they have committed abuse, you are mandated by law to report that incident, right? You have to report it. If you do not report something that would fall under a mandated reporter law, there's lots of fines and there's possible jail time, right? Because this is all what happened at the heart of Jerry Sandusky. Everybody was like, "Oh, I told so and so, and I told so and so," but nobody ever told the authorities, right? And so everybody passed the buck. And this is Pennsylvania's attempt to stop passing the buck. And so if you witness, suspect, or are told about abuse and you're a mandated reporter, you call this phone number, Pennsylvania Child Line. Pennsylvania Child Line is a nameless, faceless bureaucracy in Harrisburg that doesn't know who you are, doesn't know who the victim is, doesn't know who the abuser is, right? Because it used to be part of the frustrations with folks, why they wouldn't make reports is that they would say, well, if you have the right last name, nothing's going to happen to you, right? And every town has them. If you're in Pittsburgh, right, if your last name happened to be Rooney or Carnegie or Mellon, nothing is going to happen to you. And every town has those right last names. Well, Childline doesn't care. Like, they don't know. And so you report it to Childline, then Childline contacts your local CYS and says, look, you have to follow this up. And there's money involved and there's licensing involved. And so it's supposed to be a big stick calling Childline. You can call Childline. When you do your Childline child abuse clearance, you'll create a login information. You can actually report online. So there's that aspect to it as well. The good part about Childline is that it is a nameless, faceless bureaucracy in Harrisburg. The other bad part of it is, though, is that they're a government institution and, probably too many people or too few people for the amount of work that they have to do. There have been lots of reports about Childline, things falling through the cracks. And so what CYS workers have told me as I've done this through the years is that they say, yes, this is what the law says you have to do. But as soon as you hang up the phone, call your local CYS. You know, you're not doing anything wrong. You're simply speeding the process up. They're going to get the information anyways. You're just getting it there quicker. And, you know, 99% of the CYS folks are incredibly wonderful people who want exactly what we want, right? They want to keep kids safe. They work a very difficult job for very little money. And so, like, they're awesome. They're awesome people. And then if you also, so then you call Childline. You call CYS. If you're in an instance where you are possibly handing a child back into the hands of an abuser, or if somebody comes and they're visibly intoxicated or high on drugs, right? You cannot withhold a child from a legal parent or guardian. That's called kidnapping. And so in that instance, right, you stall, and somebody else dials 911. And you get the police here as quickly as possible, because the police will be empowered to take possession of the child, and they'll get CYS involved very quickly. And then I would just call Childline just to kind of close the loop. So, you know, one of the things with Childline, people will say, you know, there's obviously a fear, right? If I was going to take a bet this morning or this evening with you guys here today, and I won't bet because I'm a good United Methodist, and a former DS is right here, so I don't want to do that. But if I were going to place a bet, I would put all the money I have on the fact that there is not a single person here who woke up this morning saying, man, today's the day I hope I get to call Childline. You know, nobody wants to do it. But again, we do it because we're imitating Jesus, and we're standing in front of somebody and possibly rescuing a child from abuse. So if you call Childline, you can call with a question and say, this is what I saw, this is what I was told, this is what I suspect. Is this a reportable offense? And if it isn't, you just hang up the phone. There's no big deal. If it is a reportable offense, then you are required by law to give all of your information. You will have to fill out an online form called the CY-47. They'll direct you on how to do all that. The CY-47 is an extremely exhaustive form that you will not be able to answer all the questions to. I mean, like one of the questions is, what is the victim's social security number? You know, like, I don't even know my daughter's social security number. I have to ask Jan, where's Sophia's social security card? I don't know where it's at. And so, you know, if you don't know the answer, just leave a blank. You know, you fill in all the pertinent information. Now, if you call Childline and you're wrong, right, because we don't call Childline when we're 100% sure, right? We call Childline because we witness, we suspect, or we're told. And sometimes, you know, you just got the hair sticking up on the back of your neck, and you're like, there's something not right. And so you're not sure. But that's okay. We're calling to people who are trained to figure these things out. Let them do their job. Now, if you call Childline and you're wrong, right, you cannot be sued. You cannot be held financially or legally responsible for making a good faith phone call. Now, if you call Childline because your brother and sister-in-law are getting divorced and you want your brother to get a better child custody arrangement, so you make a false report against your sister-in-law, you are in a lot of trouble because you've knowingly made a false report to the government agency. And there's no protection for you. But if you're really concerned, like, make that phone call. You could be saving a child's life. You know, you're not going to be held responsible. You're held in anonymity. Right? Nobody's going to go knocking on a door saying, hey, Chris Kendall called us about you, and so we want to talk. So, yes. Yeah, that's an awesome point. Usually I add that. Right? You're not a mandated reporter for children you're not directly supervising, But I would say, you know, as a Christian, we have a moral, ethical, biblical mandate to stand in front of them if we witness, suspect, or are told about abuse. Right? So it's not just the mandated report part is for who you're accepting responsibility for. But if you see it, you should report it. Now, there are a couple categories of folks who are required to report all the time, like 24 hours a day. And one of the questions I'll get is, well, what if I see somebody in Walmart abusing a child? Am I a mandated reporter? Somebody told me I'm a mandated reporter. There are people whose jobs require them to report 24 hours a day. And if you do not know, if you're curious if that is you, it is not you. Right? Those folks know who they are. That's a big aspect of their job. And so if you have any kind of wondering if that's me, then it's not you, because they know exactly who they are. But you can call this number at any time and for any circumstance. Okay, let me get back on track here. Where was I at? So, yeah, if you make a mistake. I've only had to call, I've never had to call Childline, but I've gone to CYS. This is before I was in this position, so I really didn't know all the processes and all that. Of course, it was actually before 2014. I was in church, and I'll never forget the day, because I just finished service. I'm kind of standing there. I'm talking to folks, and I look in my back quarter section over on that side of the sanctuary. There's a gentleman talking to one of my youth, and I was recently told about this guy's background and that he had some history with young boys. And the youth that he was talking to had all of the hallmarks of victim written on him, right? He was small for his age. He came from a broken home. He was brought to church by his grandparents. He was mildly autistic. You know, this is the kind of person that a predator is going to pursue. And I just remember, you know, like, and so I beelined myself back in there and I inserted myself in their conversation. And the last thing I heard was, oh, you need to come over to my house sometime and check out my train sets. And so I made sure the youth, you know, got to his grandparents. And after church, I had to go. I went and spoke at the nursing home, preaching at the nursing home. But then I went to this guy's house. And I'll never forget sitting on a couch across from him and his wife. And I'm accusing him of grooming this young man for pedophilia. And you would have thought we were simply talking about the weather. Like, he didn't get upset. His wife was sitting right next to him. She didn't get upset. They didn't deny it. I mean, it was creepy. Because I know how I would react if somebody would say something like that to me. I would get angry. I'd get loud. I would deny it. Like, none of that happened. And then the next day, you know, I mean, I warned him a lot. And next day I went to CYS and I filed the report. You know, made sure the pastor who followed me knew who he was, knew what I did, so that he would, because he stayed a part of the church. You know, again, creepy, creepy, creepy. Don't do any of what I just did, right? You call Childline, because these people are trained. They know what they're doing. Let them do their job, because they'll do it well. You know, so I have just gone through about a 3-hour training in 10 minutes, right? There are, on our conference website, there is a free 3-hour training that the University of Pittsburgh offers to anybody who wants to learn more about mandated reporting. You know, it's free. It's 3 hours long. You can go through it. Because I flew over top of it. You know, the big keys are to remember, if you accept responsibility for a child, you are a mandated reporter. And if you are a mandated reporter, that means if you witness, suspect, or are told about abuse, you've got to call Childline. Yes.
One of the things to remember when you're reporting, because unfortunately we've had to do that several times, But when you're talking about a church situation, which most of us are in, I think Childline's great and CYS is okay. Our experience with them kind of, it hasn't been awesome because it feels like the parents either figured it out on their own or they told us that they were told it was us.
Yeah, I mean, people can make guesses for sure. But again, it's like, remember why we're doing what we're doing. And we had a trainer, Pennsylvania trainer, come into the conference a number of years ago, and he did 7 hours on mandated reporting. And boy, the stories that these people have, the number of children that die in plain sight because nobody calls, nobody makes the phone call, is astounding. You know, he gave example after example of children who should have been seen by all of these people and that nobody ever made a phone call. And it cost these children their lives. And additionally, you know, by calling this phone number, it doesn't mean that children are going to be ripped out of homes. Right? The stated goal of Children and Youth Services is to keep children in homes. And I would argue sometimes too long, you know, I mean, I would fall on that side of things, but you know, you might be calling because a child who has bad medical care, bad dental care, bad hygiene, something like that. CYS has access to funds and programs that we don't know about. You know, you might be saving a family by reporting, and then CYS steps in, and maybe there's food, there's medical care, there's dental care, there's clothing for the winter. It's just, you know, we automatically think it's all like really awful, awful stuff, and that does exist. But you know, sometimes by calling this number, we are helping a family and helping a child all at the same time. So. Any other thoughts or questions about mandated reporting, Pat? Okay. Well, you can shoot the other question.
Okay. Two questions. Does the safe sanctuary policy have to have some sort of an incident report to document any conversations?
Mm-hmm. So the question was, does the safe sanctuary policy need to have an incident report? Yeah, you know, a short pencil is better than a long memory. And so you can print out the CY-47 because it's what they're going to have to report on anyways, or you can create one of your own.
And then the second question is, does the church's safe sanctuary policy, is that a blanket policy for any outside groups using the church, or do they have to have their own, and is that independent from the church?
Yeah, so outside groups using the church following the mandated report. So like Boy Scouts have their own program. Girl Scouts have their own program that they follow. And
I'm the charter director of the Boy Scouts.
Okay. Yeah, so a lot of groups have those types of things, but if you're, you know, you can always require your groups to like do you have a policy for the care and protection of children and youth? And if they don't, then say, well, here's ours, and you need to follow it. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about some other issues here. Church-owned vehicles. Does Holiday Park have a van or anything like that? Okay. So we'll just go right to personal vehicles. So any kind of personal vehicle, right, you want to make sure that whoever's driving it is of age. If you're driving anybody, I would check you with your insurance company. You know, how old does somebody need to be if they're volunteering to drive children or youth? I'll guarantee you it's not 16, right? It's more than likely going to be 21, 23, or 25. And so, you know, you just want to keep that in mind, that if you're having volunteers driving, you want to know what your insurance company says is a legal aged driver, because it's not going to be 16. You always want to maintain two adults in every vehicle. Again, that's just one of the best practices. Two unrelated adults in a vehicle would be the best practice, right? Because if you're taking a handful of youth home after youth group, it's eventually going to be you and a youth, and that's an unsafe situation. So you want to make sure you have two adults. Ideally two unrelated adults. And if you can't do that, you have two related adults. Many times hey, Jan, I've got to run these kids home. Come on with me. Simply because it's better for me to be with her than be by myself. One of the things a lot of high school teachers have told me over the years is that high school students, if they are victims of abuse, will often accuse someone safe because they can't accuse the real perpetrator. And they accuse someone safe because they hope it eventually gets around to the guilty party. Right? So I always tell people, don't be that safe person, like, because an accusation does not need to be true to ruin a life. Be safe in the sense that when you're talking with your youth, you're with somebody else, you're never alone with them. Any kind of communications we have are always looped in with another adult, right? Because they're not doing it. The youth isn't doing it because they're mean, they're nasty. They simply can't make the accusation against a real perpetrator, right? It could be too costly for them. It could be too scary for them. And so, be safe yourself. Be a safe person for them to talk to, but don't put yourself at risk in that sense. The two-adult rule, the exception for that would be a caravan. So if you're traveling together, you're going on a mission trip, you're going to creation, something like that, and you've got three or four vehicles, you can have a single adult in each one of those vehicles because you're traveling together. You're not traveling separately. And so that would be the exception. Youth driving other youth. Youth do not drive other youth, right? Your insurance company will have kittens if they know your youth are driving kids for church events, right? My understanding is that a junior license holder can only transport one other unrelated adult with them. So they're not even any help to begin with. It's very bad. So don't do it. Now, if mom and dad say that Johnny can drive the church, it's a contract between parent and child, and the church doesn't have anything to say about it. And if mom and dad say to Johnny that Johnny can drive his younger siblings to church, it's a contract between parent and child, and we don't have anything to say about it. And if mom and dad say that Johnny can drive Susie and Susie's parents are okay with that, then Johnny can drive Susie to church. And, right, that's parents say that's okay. And so we don't have anything to say about that. But I always like to say I have a 15-year-old Sophia, and there will be no Johnny driving Sophia anytime soon. So youth do not drive themselves. One thing I forgot to say, at the two adults, don't be alone with a youth in a vehicle. I shouldn't have to say it, but I've heard at least two examples of it over the last number of years. Don't put a youth in a trunk so as to not be alone with them in a car. Yeah. One of them was at Olmsted during licensing school. Yeah, somebody was coming to be a pastor. He's no longer in process to become a pastor anymore, so that's a good thing. Yeah, but so don't put a youth in a trunk. It's not good. It's not smart. In fact, if you catch somebody putting a youth in the trunk, you should probably call Childline. That's be child abuse. Something else I shouldn't have to say, but I will, you know, never share a bed with a child, right? It's that is not a good thing to do. You know, even if it's your own child, if you're on an overnight trip, I would stay away from staying with your child. Like, you know, sometimes we'll try to save money. Don't do it. One of the things I've, you know, learned over the years is that when we go on events, right, we go on an overnight retreat, we go on a mission trip, something like that, what's happening in a child's life is there's the spiritual discipline of silence and solitude, right? It's a pulling out of what is normal, and that's it creates this anxious space where God can do some really wonderful things. And as an adult, we can short-circuit that when we want to be with our child on these events. You know, an example I can share with you. So a number of years ago, we had our first, we started taking youth to Zimbabwe. We had our annual conference has a relationship with Zimbabwe, and we were invited over. There was an international revival happening. And so we took over like 15 to 20 youth. And we made a decision very early on that parents were not allowed to go on that trip, because we had a parent who really, really, really wanted to go on that trip. And it caused us a lot of headaches, and a lot of pain, but we said no. When we came back from that trip, we video interviewed all of the youth who were a part of that first trip. And the parent of one of the children was a part of the process of asking questions. And when this parent's youth was being interviewed, the youth was just like, very short answers, one word, nothing, you know. And so the person who was videoing it said, hey, why don't you step out of the room and just for a second, let me ask a question. And as soon as the parent left the room, the youth just went crazy with the descriptions of what happened and what they experienced, you know. And so, you know, sometimes as trying to save money or whatever, you know, sharing a room with our own child on a mission trip, on a retreat, it can just short circuit what God wants to do in their lives. And so, you know, never share a bed with a child that's not yours. And on these trips, let your child have that space, because God wants to do some incredible things. Never be alone in a room with a child, right? That's an unsafe situation. Adults must be of the same gender as the students they're chaperoning. You know, Sophia is never going to go on an overnight trip with two male chaperones, right? It's never going to happen. It sounds crazy even to say it out loud. And so as soon as you have two sexes of students, you have two sexes of adults, of chaperones. Right, if it's a boy trip, then you can have two male chaperones. If it's a girl trip, you can have two female chaperones. But as soon as you got both, then you got to have both chaperoning. Hotel settings, right? Adults should never be in a room with one child. You think about what a modern hotel room setup is. You've got two queen beds, and you put an adult and a youth in one bed, and two youth in the other bed. It's a horrible idea. Don't do it. You put one adult in one bed, two youth in the other bed. It's a horrible idea. Don't do it. You put one adult in one bed, one youth in the other bed. It's a horrible idea. Don't do it. You know, ideally, what we have is we've got boy rooms and we've got girl rooms. And in between, we've got the adult chaperone rooms, right? We don't want to have the adult chaperones on the seventh floor and all the youth on the third floor. Right, nothing good comes of adults being separated by three floors. Right, we want them in between. We want them to be together. Doors should always open to hallways. Try to avoid those hotel rooms where you have doors that adjoin in between rooms, because if it's an adult room and a youth room, it can be an unsafe situation. And if it's two boy rooms together, something will get broken and you'll have to pay for it. So you always want to make sure you try to avoid those types of things. And I already talked about the adjacent rooms being best. Some of the issues around LGBTQ youth, with the hotel rooms, with overnight lodgings. There's not a lot of great answers for this one either. This is a question that gets asked at every national camping event, any national youth event. This is an issue that always comes up. So what I always try to say is, you talk. You talk with parents. You find out, what is the youth most comfortable with. And we do our best. The youth group is not a place to kick kids out of. Regardless of where we fall on that theological spectrum, right? Youth group is about learning about Jesus Christ, and so we want to do our best in making sure these kids learn about Jesus. There aren't great answers to that question. And I don't like any of the answers. I don't want kids feeling isolated. I don't want kids feeling like they're being pointed out. It's a lot of careful conversations between adults before we let the kids fall into that. And I've been asking that question for 10 years. how do we do this well? How do we do it right? How do we do it safe? Cabin settings. Cabins are a little bit different than a hotel. We have three camps within Western Pennsylvania: Wesley Woods, Jamonville, Camp Allegheny. They will often fall into, you've got boy sides, girl sides. You walk into, you've got a common space, you've got bunk rooms, and you put one adult at one exit door, you put another adult at the other exit door, and you just keep the kids from intermixing in the middle of the night. Potty policy. If you're going to do diapering, right, and a lot of churches are completely getting out of the diapering business, you want to make sure that you do diapering in an open and visible area. And I don't mean you do that in the middle of the hallway, right? We want to, protect the privacy of the child who's being changed. But at the same point, if you're doing the diapering, you don't want to be in a place where nobody can see you. So it could be like in a little alcove, a little spot in the corner of a space where it's can provide privacy, but you can be seen is the best practice. Always allow children supervised independence within using the restroom. Allow them to ask for help. Always allow for complete privacy unless it's an emergency. Get the parents involved as quickly as possible, right? They're the ones that made them. Let them be the ones to clean up after them. Always check bathrooms, particularly in times of vacation Bible school is a big one. Doors are open. People are coming in and coming out. Make sure bathrooms are safe places for kids to even go in. I was working at a vacation Bible school at a church we were attending before I started back at Concord, and I had second grade boys, and the bathroom went and it kind of curved around, and so I was actually able to stand right on the threshold of the door. I could hear everything that was going on, but I was also completely visible to the room. And the kids had complete privacy because everything was around a bend. I think your bathrooms are kind of similar like that, too. I walked into the men's room, and you could have that door open, and still everything, all the facilities were completely out of sight. But you're there, right? And so I could hear, it's like, all right, boys, flick the light, stop messing around, stop soap fighting each other, and come on out. But it's so just very safe. It's safe for me. It's safe for them. Some other final things here. Never counsel the opposite sex behind closed doors. Really, it's never counsel anybody behind closed doors. It's just a good boundary to have that, if you're talking with somebody, there's somebody nearby. Sanctuaries are great places to have awesome conversations with youth, because you can have a conversation sitting up front with a youth and have somebody sit in the back. And it's completely private, right? They're not going to be able to hear anything, but it's completely visible. And so even in a space like this sanctuary, you could have somebody on the other side of that glass kind of observing. And this becomes a very safe place to have maybe cautious or some deep conversations with youth because it's very visible. Never visit children or youth home alone, right? We don't want to insert ourselves into an unsafe situation. Take somebody with you if you're going into a home like that. Watch your dress, your language, your alcohol, tobacco, and firearm activities. Right? Youth group is not a time for a spirited discussion about the Second Amendment. Right? Youth group is about Jesus, so let's focus on what we're here to talk about and leave that other stuff to its side. Social media. If you're on social media and you have children and youth of the church connecting with you on social media, it is a very dangerous space. Stay completely away from Snapchat. Snapchat is designed, if you don't know what it is, Snapchat is a social media that is designed for everything to disappear. And so there is no proof of you saying anything or not saying anything. The rule always stands that any conversation you loop in another adult, whether it's the parent or another adult helper, you always loop somebody in. So it's never just you and a youth or you and a child having a conversation online. It's you, another adult, and the child having a conversation. And don't delete that stuff. Keep those types of records available in case anything would happen. Even as a pastor, just watching what my youth helpers were doing on social media was always very interesting too. And, what they're doing Friday night, and then they're helping out on youth on Sunday night. And sometimes it led to really cool conversations of, I see you've got a foot in two different worlds, I want to challenge you to make a decision. And sometimes, these young adults will realize that they're living a life that they shouldn't, and they make a good decision, and it's awesome when that happens. And sometimes they have to be invited not to be part of the youth group because of what they're pursuing, what they're acting like, because my kids see it, and I think they need to have good examples. So any questions on anything I've covered, haven't covered, that you got a question about tonight? No questions. If you do have any questions moving forward, right, all of my information is on the handout. Feel free to shoot me an email, and I will help you however I can. When you give offering on Sundays, part of what you give pays my salary. Because Holiday Park takes what you give and sends a portion into the conference center, and that's how I get paid. And so I work for Holiday Park United Methodist Church. My office happens to be in Cranberry, but I work for you guys. And so however I can be of help and assistance to you, I'm more than happy to do that. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to come and talk with you. And if you have any questions, let's continue to talk together about those questions. And Pat has, so if you came tonight, there's certificates of completion. If you would like something like that, just it gives you some record that you have completed the Safe Sanctuary training. So let's say a prayer together. Gracious God, we are grateful tonight for this opportunity to talk about something, Lord, that I trust is near and dear to your heart. How do we care for the vulnerable in our midst? How do we care for those who cannot stand up for themselves? And so, Lord, we pray that you would continue to motivate us, Lord, to prod us into making sure that everything we can do to make Holiday Park a safe sanctuary, that we would do it. Lord, I pray for all the children and youth that call this church home. I pray for all those, Lord, who may be looking for a home, that they would feel drawn here, that they would feel welcome here. Lord, we pray, Lord, I pray against, abuse. I pray, Lord, that the men and women who would be volunteering here would be safe and protected, Lord, as they stand up for the children of this church. and the children of this community. And so help us, Lord, with all of this, we pray. In Jesus, it's in your name. Amen.